Welcome, and thank you all for holding. I'd like to inform parties that your lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer portion. To ask a question, press star one. Today's conference is also being recorded. If anyone has any objections, you may disconnect. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Amy Fricke. You may begin.
Thank you, Holly. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar. My name is Amy Fricke, and I am one of the organizers for today's call. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us today. Today's webcast is presented by the Illinois Department of Human Services, Division of Mental Health, and the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative. The title of today's webcast is Effective Utilization of a Certified Recovery Support Specialist Professional. This is part two, Complex Relationships. I would like to introduce to you Mr. Bryce Goff, Director of Recovery and Resilience.
Great. Thank you, Amy. Welcome to today's webinar. As Amy mentioned, today is the second part of a four-part training series. Our previous session was on preparation and planning for hiring CRSS professionals, and that PowerPoint is available on our website, which we'll give out later, but that is www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com. Today's session, as Amy mentioned, is on complex relationships. We also have two future sessions coming soon. The next one will be on January 17th, and that is titled Professional Training. And the final webinar in this series on the effective utilization of CRSS professionals will be on February 28th, and the topic will be program sustainability. So we're really looking forward to today's call and for your participation in the future calls.
Bryce, before we begin the formal presentation, I would like to review with everyone a few helpful tools and housekeeping items for the online portion of the forum.
Sure.
If you happen to get disconnected from the audio portion, please call back into the same number you just dialed in, which is 1-888-677-0065, and the passcode is Illinois. The visual portion of this presentation is web-based. Of course, you can choose the audio portion only, but if you would like to log in to see the webinar, presentation, and PowerPoint, the login information is located on the invite you received after you registered. If you are experiencing any problems with this particular link to join, you can also go to www.joinwebinar.com and enter the web ID number, which is 874-175-098. There will be a designated question and answer portion towards the end of today's presentation. We ask that attendees hold their questions until the designated question and answer period. The operator will then open the lines for you at that time. And lastly, at the conclusion of the presentation today, we ask that you please complete the brief satisfaction survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum. It should take you less than 5 minutes to complete the survey, and we value your feedback. Without further ado, we will now begin the formal presentation, and I will turn the call back over to Mr. Bryce Goff. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Amy.
So you're welcome.
To introduce our speakers for today, our presenters. First, we will have Nanette Larson, who is the Director of Recovery Support Services for the Department of Human Services, Division of Mental Health. You'll hear us abbreviating that as DMH. Again, I'm Bryce Goff. I'm the Director of Recovery and Resilience with the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative for Access and Choice. And we'll also have Dan Wilson, who's a Peer and Family Support Specialist with the Collaborative. Dan and Nanette, welcome.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Next, we're going to go over our objectives for today's call. Participants will learn how to clarify and communicate CRSS roles, effective ways to supervise staff and elevate morale, appropriate ways to assist if a staff person is experiencing a mental health challenge. We'll also be learning policies which effectively address interpersonal interactions, how to avoid diagnosing staff, and proactive ways to maintain staff members' confidentiality. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dan Wilson, who's going to be talking to us about role clarification. Dan?
Okay, thank you, Bryce. And Role confusion is the number one obstacle to effective utilization of a CRSS professional. So, for a moment, let's imagine that you apply for a job as a quality control specialist at a fried chicken restaurant. I know this may be hard to kind of picture with what we're talking about, but this is just a scenario to kind of bring the point to view. Okay, on your first day of work, you're trained to fry chicken. And a month later, you're still frying chicken. And there's nothing wrong with frying chicken, of course, but you are wondering why you are frying chicken when you thought you were going to be controlling the quality of various aspects of work at the restaurant. And your coworkers know that your title is different from theirs, and they're starting to wonder, so why is this guy frying chicken when he has the title of a quality control specialist? What's he really here for? Is he covertly monitoring our chicken frying quality? Is your supervisor, is he being paid more than us? What makes his job different from ours? Finally, you ask your supervisor, if you had misunderstood what the role was to be, she responds, well, you basically do the same thing as everyone else. We just changed the title to convey to the world that the quality of our chicken is the best in the world. And I mean, your coworkers already make good chicken. You know, it's kind of like our version of sandwich art. Okay, as in this case with any position, it is important for a CRSS professional position to have clear roles within the organization. And this is not only helpful for the person you've hired, but for everyone in the organization, including supervisors, CRSS staff, coworkers, and persons served. Next, I'd like to talk about strategic placement of CRSS roles within an organization. And you may be wondering, how are we going to strategically position this person within your organization? And sometimes people assume, okay, CRSS positions should go under the clinical department because they are providing direct services. That may be true, but have you stopped to consider other options? Perhaps there could be a recovery support development that is parallel to clinical with its own director. Perhaps the CRS professional is under clinical and providing direct services, but also plays a consultative and training role to multiple areas within the organization. Will this staff person function as a leader, a service provider, a trainer, or some combination? Will there be more than one position at different levels of the center? So, how can you most effectively position this role so that the CRSS professional has transformative impact on the whole organization? These are questions that can help you make the best use of the unique skill sets of the CRSS staff. Clear job descriptions and expectations are key to success, and it's important to communicate the role clearly and broadly among all staff, and provide adequate training and mentoring opportunities. In other words, how is this role different from others, and how does it work with others? And it may be a good idea that your staff may need opportunities to ask questions and share their concerns before the person is hired, or even before the program is started. CRSS professionals experience the greatest impact of the transition from consumer and staff. Provide direction, support, and supervision during this time. Consider establishing a network of support within your organization for staff members. And I'd like to pause on that first point for a moment and share a practical example. Often when a CRSS professional comes to work in a mental health center, they experience more than just a typical adjustment to a new job. We have found that without the kinds of principles we are discussing in today's training, expectations have been unclear and that they must learn to define or shape their role for themselves and for other staff. They sometimes face assumptions from others that their potential is limited. Sometimes their coworkers wonder if hiring this new type of position will threaten their job security. The new staff person may not only wonder, what do my new coworkers think of me? But they may also wonder, what do my new coworkers think of me when they know I experienced mental illness? Well, wait a minute. Actually, who knows and who doesn't know? In addition, entering a mental health treatment facility may remind a person of some of the most difficult experiences of their lives and impact their self-esteem. However, when effective direction, support, and supervision occurs, these effects may be limited. Many CRSS professionals find that, despite the adjustment, working in mental health helps them to turn what may have been their greatest life challenge into their greatest gift and contribution to others. You may consider helping the new staff person to establish a network of support within an organization. Is there a mentoring opportunity for this staff person? Or how can we fully incorporate them into the team to give and receive support? So now I'd like to bring Nanette into the program, and she's going to talk about supervisory relationships.
Thank you, Dan. So, yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about the supervisory relationship. First, just let's review a few of these brief points. Obviously, supervisors must be prepared to establish helpful, positive boundaries. It's important to remember that we must resist the inclination to bring any therapeutic training that we might have into the supervisory relationship, and also to keep in mind that an individual cannot be a supervisor and a mental health provider to the same person. So this is an introductory slide to this section in this discussion on the supervisory relationship, and probably is just shedding light on the things that you would already know. But I want to add a little bit more to this conversation, some things that I think about when I talk about this with folks. First of all, we have to remember that one out of four Americans, according to our statistics, has a diagnosable mental health condition. Current reports show that upwards of 25% of Americans are taking mental health medications. So what does that mean? Well, basically, we're talking that you are most likely already supervising staff with mental illnesses or a history thereof, and therefore the fact that you are now supervising a person who has self-disclosed mental illness is the only new piece. It's that self-disclosure that makes the difference. So we have this situation where we're dealing with a person who is our supervisee who has self-disclosed they have a mental illness, and therefore we might be looking at them differently. So let's talk about that for a minute. We all have lenses through which we view the world, and obviously we change those lenses of perception based on our context. So by way of metaphor, a person may wear reading glasses to read, but use sunglasses when they're outside to shield their eyes from the sun. If they were in the military, they might need to use night vision goggles to see in the dark. So obviously we select the right lenses for the right context. Many of us who are supervisors in mental health have had some degree of clinical training, and that is obviously very positive. So when we know that an employee has a mental illness, we may have a natural tendency to put on our clinical lenses and interpret what they say to us through those lenses. However, we need to remember that we are supervisors in this context, and we have to resist the inclination to diagnose our staff or assume a person is experiencing symptoms when they're having a rough day on the job. Let's remember to treat our CRSS staff as we do any other staff within the organization, as a supervisor who balances a sense of objective professionalism with genuine care and concern for the persons that we supervise. So now we're going to be talking about what to do if a CRSS professional appears to be experiencing a mental health challenge affecting their work. So first thing that I would suggest is that you ask yourself, how would I deal with this situation with any other staff person? For example, if one of your social workers were crying a lot on the job, how would you handle that situation? Would you consider calling their doctor? My guess is probably not. And the only reason that I would mention that is because with a person who is a peer support professional or a CRSS professional, it has been suggested that if they come to work crying, that maybe we should call their psychiatrist. But if you contextualize it with those goggles that you're used to wearing as a supervisor, you wouldn't think of calling somebody's doctor if you didn't know that they have a mental health condition. So how would you handle it in any other situation? Assure the employee of your support and encourage them to use and expand their support network outside of the workplace. I would also suggest that you tap into your human resource departments and their expertise. They do know how to handle healthcare situations, and they often know how to respond or what the resources are that are available to an employee who is having difficulty. Just on a side note, I will suggest, however, that when you're talking with human resources or actually with anybody about, you know, what should I do? So maybe you're talking with your supervisor and say, what do I do? We have to keep in mind that how we ask the question may steer the conversation. So rather than going to human resources or going to your supervisor and saying, you know, this peer specialist who has a mental illness seems to be, you know, having symptoms, what do I do? You might just say, one of my supervisees seems to be having some difficulty. How would I handle that? Because if you frame it by putting that person in a box, you're probably going to get the boxed answer back instead of getting a more broad scope of how you might be able to respond. So I want to go back to this piece about expanding the support network outside of the workplace, and we're going to talk a little bit more further down the road about how to respond if the person seems to be having difficulty. But we're just going to kind of talk a little bit here about the piece about expanding the support network outside of the workplace. First of all, ensuring that the peer specialist or the CRSS professional has connections with other CRSS professionals. These persons are their professional peer network. A good parallel here would be like the National Association of Social Workers, or the NASW. That's the peer professional network for the social work community. And so for CRSS professionals, their ability to connect with other peer support specialists or other persons that are doing this kind of work helps them to feel connected to and have some peer professional connections. So there are ways that they can do that. A great example here in the state of Illinois is the Peer Mentorship Learning Collaborative. This is a great opportunity for folks that are doing this work to connect with others in Illinois who are doing this work. If you're not familiar with that, if you're interested in your program, if you have an active peer support program and you're interested in becoming a participant, you can contact me and I will get you in touch with those who are in charge of that program. That's actually facilitated by Jordan Litvak, and they've just been doing excellent things to help the peer connections occur in our state. And on the national level, there is a national organization called the National Association of Peer Specialists, or NAPS, if you spell out the acronym. There's also the DMH Recovery Support Specialists in each region that can serve as peer mentors for these programs. And then lastly, involvement in the recovery conferences. At recovery conferences, your staff may find a morale boost, great networking opportunities, and an opportunity to get expanded opportunities for education in the work that they're doing. So again, talking a little bit more about what to do if a CRSS professional appears to be experiencing a mental health challenge affecting their work. Number one, I think the most important thing is that we have to be very careful of assumptions. Again, kind of tying that back to the point about do what you would do in this situation with any other employee. Start with work-based questions an open dialogue with the staff person. How are you feeling about your job responsibilities? What's your favorite thing about this work? Is there anything we can do to make this position more rewarding for you? These questions may open the door for the employee to self-disclose a challenge if they are having one and if they choose to do so. But it helps you to kind of broaden your perspective and make sure you're not using those night vision goggles in a situation that may not require them. So as we were preparing for this presentation, Bryce had shared with us that he had a brief example that fit very nicely in this piece here. So Bryce, I'm going to turn to you to ask if you could share a bit about that example.
Sure, I'd be happy to, Nanette. Well, I started working in the mental health field originally a little over a decade ago, and I was hired at that time in a role that was called Consumer Services Specialist, but it was a position where I had a self-disclosed mental health history, and folks were aware of that fact, and I was hired partly to develop a peer support program. And I was really excited. I got to spend a lot of time with the person served at the mental health center, getting to know their gifts and their strengths and talents, and finding out how I could help them to start up peer support groups where they could share their skills with others and be mentors to one another. And we had a really successful start to the program. Things were going great. But as often happens in any organization, we had a change of leadership at the time, and someone came in from another area who wasn't as familiar with what my role was intended to be. And so there were a lot of changes made. The setting became more restrictive than it had been in the past. And rather than discovering gifts and talents and mentoring people into supportive roles, the expectation on me changed to where I was more intended to monitor people who came into the program and make sure basically, you know, everything was safe in the room and really get away from that peer support program development role that I was hired for. So, you know, I'm sure we can all relate to times when our jobs have sort of changed on us. And at the time, you know, it was pretty discouraging for me. I went from doing what I really loved to monitoring people. So, you know, I think my coworkers could tell. You know, I wasn't kind of the same Bryce. I was kind of discouraged about what was going on with my job at the time. And my new supervisor picked up on that as well. So in supervision, she called me into her office, and the first question was, Bryce, are you experiencing symptoms? And to give this a little more context, this, you know, was pretty soon within our working relationship, and while she knew that I had a mental health history, you know, our supervisory relationship and our relationship at all hadn't developed to the point where I had gotten an opportunity to share any specifics of my story. And so she didn't know that I had not experienced, you know, significant mental health challenge for several years, and that really was what I was experiencing was job dissatisfaction. And so that was difficult. I mean, it was difficult for me. It's, you know, it was a little discouraging to hear that she would jump to that question. But fortunately, we got to talk about it, and I got to share my feelings about that a little bit and explain how the job was changing and how I felt, you know, this position, my position, could be made better use of. And over time, she came to understand that, and then we worked together to start developing you know, a really great peer support program at the time. So all that is to say, or to illustrate the points on the slide, which are start with asking the person about the job and about their job satisfaction. And again, you know, if I were having a mental health challenge at the time, if I were experiencing symptoms, then maybe that would have opened the door for me to share that if I chose to do so.
Mm-hmm. That's a good example, Bryce, and I appreciate you sharing that. That's a very real moment, and it certainly, at least for me, you know, brings to light that piece about the night vision goggles, you know, because it sounds like in that situation that the supervisor was, you know, only had one set of goggles on and saw you and what she, you know, thought she saw in one way only and didn't, you know, even consider that it was something else. And quite honestly, that would be very discouraging to me and probably to anybody. So, yeah, thank you for sharing that with us.
Sure.
Okay, so we're going to continue on to talk about, okay, so Nanette, you've been saying all these things that, you know, what to do, but I'm still struggling with what am I supposed to do? You know, I've asked my supervisee, you know, are they satisfied with the job? They're saying they're satisfied with the job, and it still sounds like they're having trouble, and, you know, I'm not sure what I'm supposed to be doing to help them that is appropriate. Well, again, we kind of try to put these things in the context of what you would do with any other employee. Remind the person of the employee assistance program and other benefit options that you would have available to them within your organization. Approach those situations with the same policies and methods as you would with any primary health challenge that they might have. If you see a person who's really struggling, they don't seem well enough to be at work. That's kind of what we're talking about. We're talking about a person who doesn't seem well enough to be at work. You know, you want to provide them with the options that they need or that they have available to them and encourage them to take advantage of those options. If they do choose to take time off work to address their health needs, you know, I personally feel that it's very important that you work with them to develop a plan to transition back to work successfully. Obviously, I don't think that you need to do that before they leave, you know, because that they're not well at that moment. They're trying to make sure that you're just taking care of their health at that moment. But as they're preparing to come back and as they're calling and saying, I'm well enough to come back, or they say, my doctor has released me to come back to work, I do think a transition back to work plan is really important. That's probably going to help their longer-term success getting back to work and staying back at work more successfully. And you may also want to consider talking with and thinking through with the employee potential reasonable accommodations. In other words, time off work is not the only option. Time off work may not be necessary at all. Maybe some modifications in the workplace or the work load or the work setting could be made so that they can stay on the job successfully. And in the end, you're going to have a more productive employee. You're going to have a more happy situation for everybody, and it may turn out, you know, in some ways better than it would have been to start with. So a couple of reminders about the things that we want to make sure we don't do. Obviously, you want to avoid diagnosing your staff. You know, we recognize that many clinicians are really outstanding diagnosticians, and it's a very important clinical skill, but it's not a good thing to bring that into the supervisory relationship. So just be very cautious about how you use that strength and that skill in this context. It's not appropriate to ask if the staff member is taking medication. It's not appropriate to ask if the staff member is experiencing symptoms. You know, as in Bryce's example where the opening question was, you know, Bryce, are you experiencing symptoms? Symptoms of dissatisfaction on the job, you know. That'd be what that's a symptom of. But, you know, and a couple more on the, you know, advisory notes. Don't attribute employee performance challenges to a mental health challenge. If they're having trouble getting the work done, it just may be they need, you know, some assistance getting the work done. It may have nothing at all to do with the mental health challenge. It could have to do with employee-coworker relationships. It could have to do with, you know, all kinds of different things, as it would with any other staff person. And, of course, it's a big no-no about speculating with any of these things with other staff within the organization. So I just want to comment that, you know, these things that I'm mentioning here are not shared to be pejorative in any way. I recognize that the folks that are listening into these trainings are most likely aware of the need to avoid diagnosing employees, obviously. But at the same time, these things have been added to this training because, sadly, we have actually seen these actual things occur in the field. So I think it's important, and it does no harm to reemphasize the importance of these things. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Bryce, and Bryce is going to talk with us a little bit more about the supervisory relationship, but in the context of improving staff morale.
Okay, thank you very much, Nanette. So let's talk about staff morale. Promoting staff morale, it's important to maintain high yet achievable expectations, as you would with any other staff person. To discover your staff's gifts and skill sets. After all, I mean, I think this is one of the most enjoyable things about being a supervisor is discovering people's gifts and skill sets and putting those to good use. Constantly reevaluate with the employees the areas that they would like to grow in and be challenged in. You know, we've probably all had jobs where these principles of staff morale has been practiced and jobs where they were not. Sometimes even a change in a supervisor, like I was sharing in my story, or different workplace circumstances may lead to kind of a roller coaster effect on staff morale. These principles are really about harnessing the passion and gifts of your employees and channeling them in productive ways. So even on a team where more than one staff have the same title, you'll find diversity in those staff's talents. Once you discover those talents, you can work with them to have different emphases so everyone is used to their maximum potential. More about staff morale. Ensure full membership on the team and in decision-making processes. You want to expect to be respectfully challenged. After all, CRSS professionals are agents of positive change. I kind of want to pause there because I think that's a really important point. If CRSS professionals came into the field just having the same perspectives of everyone else, I'm not sure that we would necessarily need a CRSS credential. But the fact that there is a credential and a unique set of skills and perspectives is something that we want to value. So if you're hiring someone intentionally to have a different perspective from you, a different angle, then you can expect to be respectfully challenged. But I think respect, of course, is the key there. Celebrate successes and how these successes further the organization's vision. I think in terms of the second point there, expect to be respectfully challenged. When we were going through the presentation and preparing, Nanette, you had a great example from an orientation you had to working in a mental health hospital. Would you mind sharing that with us?
Sure, Bryce, thank you. It was actually my first job with the Division of Mental Health, and I was hired to work in one of the state hospitals. And within the first couple of days of being hired, I was being given a tour of the hospital by the hospital administrator, who's, essentially the top dog of the organization. And as she was walking me through the hospital, she said to me several times on our tour, Nanette, we've hired you because we need a new set of eyes, and we need your perspective, and we want to hear what you see. We want you to tell us what you see. We want to know what you see. And she kind of made the point that, every new employee sees something new and sees something different. But because I had been on the other side of the desk, so to speak, because I had been a patient in a hospital, I had a different set of eyes than those of other persons that are hired. Or, as I had said in my previous comments, they were hiring me to bring those eyes.
Mm-hmm.
I personally believe that a lot of our staff probably have those eyes, but we don't ask them to use them.
Yeah.
But she was making the point that that's why they were hiring me, was to use those eyes and to look through those eyes and to use those lenses from my lived experience, and that she personally wanted to hear that. And it was it made a huge impression on me as a new employee. Because I recognized very early, within the first week of being hired that I was not hired as a token. I was not hired as some kind of a, this is a new initiative that I'm, that, you know, it's the thing of the day. She was genuinely saying, this is what we need you for. This is why you're here, is for you to help us see things that, and she actually had, at that point in time, been working in the field for over 30 years. And she said, you know, in over 30 years of doing what I do, I still can't see what you're going to be able to see. And that's why you're here. And it just made a huge impression on me that, that being hired as an agent of change and bringing that viewpoint was valued.
That's really powerful, and I just love that phrase, we need new eyes. Mm-hmm. I think that's something we should use more often. That's great, Nanette. So on the last point on this slide, celebrate successes. Whenever there's a new program, folks will question the longevity of that program and, you know, is this program producing results? And so you want to ask yourself the question, how will you convey the results of a new recovery support program throughout your organization to all staff? Ask yourself, how do you convey the glimmer of hope in individuals' eyes that we see when CRSS professionals are doing their thing and people are getting that hope? How do we convert that into some kind of concrete result that could convey the value of what the recovery support program is doing, even to an accountant, someone just looking at the numbers? How do we convert that hope and those outcomes into numbers that show, hey, this program is really valuable and it's making a difference? But how might these unique skills even help you to market your organization's unique approach within the community or to the DMH? Both supervisor and staff can help one another to keep the primary focus of supervision on the job. I think this is important. It's a two-way street for the supervisor and the employee to make sure that when they're in supervision, the focus is primarily on the job. Now, that doesn't mean you can't ever talk about kind of what's going on in life, but the primary focus should be on the job. In other words, what needs to be accomplished? What is the best way to get the work done? And is any support being requested to perform work tasks? And, you know, we've talked a little bit about the supervisor's lenses through which they're interpreting the professional relationship with the employee. But if you stop to think a little bit about the new CRSS professional, especially if this is their first job in mental health, coming into a supervisory setting, okay, here we have an office, some nice couches, I'm meeting with this clinician here, who's my supervisor, but we're almost trained when we get in that setting to look at it from a therapeutic perspective, even as the employee. And so it's good to be aware that some of those dynamics might be there. So really it's a mutual accountability to keep the focus on the job. So in face-to-face supervision time, set the expectation that the main focus is upon the employee bringing their questions, their suggestions, and their proposed solutions to the discussion time. The supervisor can also use these times to provide feedback and assess job satisfaction, of course. But this time allows, again, for discovery of gifts, skills, and new areas for professional development. You know, I think most people are aware of this, but for every negative, I think it's helpful to share two positives. And be aware that at times you may need to address an employee's own feelings that they're not doing the work well when in fact they are. I can think of a time not too long ago when one of my staff, you know, came to me and said, you know, I just don't feel like I'm, you know, performing at the level that I'm used to. You know, I'm kind of discouraged at my performance lately. And, you know, I honestly had to say something like, well, you know, when you go from, like, super overperforming and just excellent work every day and, you know, blowing my expectations out of the park or whatever, to just being a really great staff person, that's still being a really great staff person. So I think it helps to be aware that sometimes employees' feelings about how they're doing might be out of proportion to what we're thinking. And so it's good to have those face-to-face check-in times together. Another thing that can be really helpful is to supervise around the competencies of the CRSS credential. How do we do that in a practical way? Well, one of the things we can do is use the CRSS study guide or the Illinois CRSS model. These are booklets that are available online. We'll share some web addresses later on. But these are resources that you can regularly use in supervision sessions. You can use them as a tool to work through the manuals together with your staff. And there are just so many different skills within the domains of the CRSS credential that are not only listed, but are talked about and explained. Anything from active listening skills to suicide prevention, ethics of the credential, just to name a small fraction of what's in there. But that's also mutually beneficial because it doesn't only help your staff person, but it helps you as a supervisor to be really sharp and on top of, okay, what are the unique domains of the CRSS credential? And what are the different approaches that CRSS professionals are expected to take? So to wrap up this piece of the presentation, when we're supervising around the competencies of the CRSS credential, you should know that there are four domains that are the framework of the credential, and those are advocacy, recovery support, professional responsibility, and mentoring. So again, this will just help all the more to keep the emphasis on supervision on skills rather than personal issues. And it proactively trains staff rather than reactively addressing any potential shortcomings. So I think those are all fairly important points about the supervisory relationship, particularly with CRSS professionals. And so with that, I'm going to cue Dan to come back on. And Dan's going to talk to us a little bit about different policy questions that you might consider. Dan?
Yeah, thank you, Bryce. And you know, when it comes to policies, it may be a time to kind of look at what are current policies concerning relationships between staff and consumers, or even conflicts of interest. So there's a couple of things that maybe we can, you know, to it'd be beneficial to look at and go over and think about. And also kind of look at, are policies still relevant and sufficient to address present-day situations? You know, sometimes policies may get outdated as far as the movement in the field, and so it's important to kind of review those and see if they can be changed or tweaked a little bit to fit the situation now. And do the policy clearly define boundaries? Boundaries is a very important part of the CRS professional and other staff also. Are revisions necessary to reflect a commitment to hiring current or former consumers of service? And you can ask your current staff, how are these policies working for you? In other words, maybe the staff have had some concerns about it and maybe just hasn't brought it up to get addressed yet, so that, you know, offering that opportunity can be a very, very beneficial thing when it comes to that. And also approach your policies with a fresh set of eyes. And also, are policies about relationships so strict that they isolate CRS staff from both persons served and their coworkers? Or, what is the clinical justification for the policy? Or, how do our policies protect our consumers and staff? And I think it's important that we need to be careful that our policies do not result in isolating the CRSS staff from both persons served and their coworkers. Because it's a very, from my own experience, it's kind of a that feeling of being alone and not part of the team. And so I think if that can be addressed first off, you know, I think it can save the CRS professional as well as other staff some of that frustration and concern they may have. Whether you're located in a small town or in big city, we increasingly live in small worlds. And I believe it's unrealistic to expect that paths will not cross outside of work. Is avoiding eye contact or pretending not to know someone who approaches you in public effective in accomplishing the goal of protecting individuals? And sometimes it might help to just think if you were in that situation and you saw somebody you knew and they just kind of looked away and went on, and think about how that made you feel. So let's keep the focus on the heart of the matter, which is protecting consumers and staff. Finally, if you have not yet had a conversation with human resources and staff about Facebook and other social network realities, now might be a good time to do so. Does your organization have a unified approach to social networking between consumers and staff? Another good idea is to brainstorm possible dual role situations between staff and clients, and maybe differentiate between relationships that existed prior to employment from those initiated during the professional helping relationship. And it's really important and crucial to involve staff, managers, and consumers in establishing policy guidelines to apply on a case-by-case basis. Also, I think the key to success is clearly written policies with a standard for case-by-case application to the policy by designing a policy that documents the underlying principles and relegate the application to a case-by-case analysis. And also, it's important to develop principles which guide decision-making around issues that arise, and identifying what is essential, non-negotiable, and make that be the policy, and then everything else can be handled case by case. And also keep in mind that CRSS professionals may be able to help you find ways to communicate your policies to persons served in such a way that the policies convey the value of those policies to the individual. Here is a great example that we found of a clear policy. Sure, it does not answer every question or scenario that might arise, but I think it gives a clear, simple principle about romantic or sexual relationships in particular that a supervisor can help staff to apply. And that in the example is, in order to protect the department's clients from abuse associated with the imbalance of power between clients and staff, staff may neither initiate nor maintain romantic and or sexual relationships with clients the department presently serves, nor does those recently closed within the past 2 years. Employees recently hired with prior such relationships must promptly report these to their manager, who will work with the clinical deputy for case-by-case resolution. Good policies address what is essential and inform the staff and supervisor's judgment in various situations, as the example showed. So then let those principles inform situational judgment with supervisory support. So now I'd like to bring back Nanette. She can talk to you a little bit about confidentiality.
Thanks so much, Dan. So, yeah, we're going to just spend a little bit of time here emphasizing confidentiality in particular. You may be wondering how confidentiality fits into this conversation. What we're going to be talking about is training around confidentiality, managing access to charts, and also protecting the CRSS staff person's confidentiality if they have a history of treatment at the mental health center where they are now working. So a few basic principles. First, inform new employees of their duty to uphold confidentiality. Consider using written and signed confidentiality agreements. And remember that confidentiality agreements apply whether the new staff member has a mental health treatment history or not. Obviously, those statements that are there are true of all employees. And so the point being that CRSS professionals are held to the same standards regarding confidentiality as any other professional within your organization, and therefore the policies regarding situations around confidentiality would be handled in similar ways as well. So let's talk about access to consumer files. What rules will govern your staff's access to consumer files? The general rule regarding access to files and charting depends on the staff member's role. A basic example here is that, you know, obviously the janitor in your organization does not have need for access to consumers' files. So it's based on their role. However, the CRSS professional, the peer support worker, is in a direct service role in almost all situations, and therefore it's customary for them to have a need for and would have access to consumer charts. So you would require charting if it's customary for other staff who are performing related activities to be charting. So the question has arisen, we wouldn't be talking about this here if it hasn't been part of our conversation with agencies. So please don't think that we're talking down to you. If this is all already known, then we accept that you already knew it. But we have had these conversations with agencies, and so that's why it's part of this training. Yes, the CRSS professional would write in the chart if they are performing duties that any other staff person doing those duties would write in the chart about. So if they're, facilitating a group, leading a class, if they're having one-on-one interactions with consumers, and those types of interactions would normally be charted by any other staff person, then the CRSS professional would be charting about that as well. You would obviously require charting if the staff member's contact with the consumers necessitates it. And then kind of as a side note, you want to keep in mind that it's generally accepted that we avoid charting on self-help or 12-step activities. Remember that in most cases you are hiring these individuals to provide billable mental health services, so charting and therefore having access to charts is in most cases essential. So there, we need to talk about the fact that in some situations it is appropriate to limit access. Obviously, because of the complexity of these relationships, the complexity of the jobs that these persons are being hired into, there may be situations where it is appropriate to limit access. The example on the chart here, on your slide here, is limiting access to the charts of other group therapy members by the staff person who may continue to take part in a particular group. From a clinical point of view, if I am participating in a therapy group with five other persons from the same organization where I am an employee, it would be counter-therapeutic for me to have access to those five persons' charts that are in that therapy group with me. And so you would want to limit my access to those five persons' charts. That would not mean, however, that I would therefore have no access to any charts, period, because I am still receiving services in the organization. It simply means that we would have to come up with some method by which you would limit my access to those charts of those persons that are in that therapy group with me. From a personal example point of view, I can share a story where this was kind of real to me, and I tend to share this when I'm talking on the phone with agencies who are asking these kinds of questions because it seems to make it real to them, and it kind of brings an aha moment when I share it. I had been working as a case manager at a homeless shelter, and in that job I was not a self-disclosed mental health professional. You know, I was not in a CRSS role of any kind. I was simply a case manager at a homeless shelter. And at that location, a family member of mine checked into the shelter. And my supervisor, you know, came to me and very respectfully notified me that my family member would not be placed on my caseload, and that also my family member's file would be put under lock and key in her office so that I would not have access to it, and that my family member would be informed of this as well, so that my family member would feel comfortable coming in and out of the shelter and not feeling like all of their business was, you know, becoming family business you know, because I worked at the place where they were getting services. And so it just kind of drilled home that point to me. And so when I started working in this field and doing the work that I do, it just seemed kind of an obvious carryover of something that I understood that you would do, that you would kind of protect those charts of persons that you have relationships with outside of the workplace. So you want to ask yourself, what policies do you have for your existing staff when it comes to their access to charts of persons that they might have had pre-existing relationships with outside of the workplace? And simply apply those policies in this situation. So I think that a really key point is just to be very cautious about developing any kind of a blanket approach to limiting chart access. There's probably no reason to limit in a blanket way, chart access, but rather simply to identify those specific situations and limit those specific charts in those situations. So the other piece that kind of becomes sticky about confidentiality in this context is protecting the confidentiality of the staff person who has been hired, who is or was formerly a consumer or a client of your agency. When this occurs, this is sometimes completely overlooked, that this person is now a staff person and is now a coworker, and therefore their mental health records should not be open access to their coworkers just because they're a consumer or were a consumer of the agency. You would not think it appropriate for your social work staff, your MDs, for their mental health records to be shipped over to your agency and put in the regular consumer files so that all staff could see them. And this is the same situation. So you want to make sure that you have some method or mechanism by which you can sequester charts of employees who are current or were former recipients of services of your organization. One method that can be used is that those records could be maintained under pseudonyms, and then you would keep a matching list of the names and the pseudonyms in the director's office so that only a select number of persons would know who those names are, and the select number would be persons that need to know. It's on a need-to-know basis. And you also want to just consider other ways that confidentiality could be compromised and take any appropriate prevention steps. An important note in this electronic world that we live in is to keep in mind that we have to consider how we are managing and limiting access in this electronic world. I think that it was far simpler, my example of the homeless shelter, it was far simpler for my supervisor to simply lift that file out of a 10-drawer filing cabinet and just walk it down the office and lock it up in her office than it is in these days when so many organizations are dealing with electronic health records, and in the future it'll be even more of that. So we have to keep in mind that we have to strategize those things and work through those things as we move more into electronics. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bryce to tell us what's coming up.
Thanks, Nanette, and thanks, Dan. I think some great points on today's call. I want to encourage everyone to stay tuned because coming up next, we have a question and response time. And to me, this is the most valuable part of any presentation, the opportunity to not only ask questions yourselves, but to hear other people's questions that you might share or that you might not have thought of. So we're going to have question and response time next. I did want to remind everyone that we are having two more webinar training sessions in this series on professional training, January 17th, and program sustainability of recovery support programs on February 28th. So please join us again for those as well. We realize that there are multiple levels of complexity to the issues brought up today, and that we've, of course, not covered everything. For example, we didn't really take a lot of time to address issues related to complex coworker relationships. We talked about supervisory, we talked about relationships with persons served, but we didn't talk a lot about coworker relationships. So if you have questions about that or anything else related to the CRSS credential and working with people with the credential, We encourage you to ask those more specific questions in the Q&A time. Now, you may be wondering, where can I find more information? And we've listed just a few resources here, but the nice thing about especially these websites is once you go and take a look at one resource, they're going to lead you to a lot of other resources. So the first one is the Illinois Certification Board's website. Now, the Illinois Certification Board is also known as IAODAPCA. So on their website, you can find the Illinois CRSS Credential Study Guide and also the Illinois Model for Mental Health CRSS, which includes the ethics of the credential and application. So you can find so much good information on the site. It's www.iaodapca.org. www.ioadapca.org. The next website I'd like to draw your attention to is the Illinois Mental Health Collaborative's website. We actually have a section on the CRSS credential. And so if you go into our website, www.IllinoisMentalHealthCollaborative.com, and click on Consumers and Families, over in the left-hand menu, you'll see a CRSS section. And that has, over 10 resources, I'm sure. But one of them that I like and that I think is particularly applicable to today's presentation, I sort of have a love-hate relationship with the title of this. I'll just read it. Oh, no, we've hired consumers. Okay, obviously I don't like that part. But I love the subtitle, which is Personnel Policies and Practices for People in Recovery and Everyone Else. And that really underscores what we've been talking about a lot today, that a lot of these policies apply to everyone in the organization. It's just that when someone is self-disclosed, sometimes we need to take off those clinical lenses. So there is a more specific link there on the slide that you can go to. But if you just go to our website, it's fairly easy to find. And the final resource I have written here is a great book. It's called Good to Great and the Social Sectors. You may have heard of the book called Good to Great by Jim Collins that's just really helped a lot of organizations with transformation and leadership principles. But this smaller version called Good to Great and the Social Sectors just has some great insights that I think as you're heading up or over an organization with a recovery support program, you can find some great tips in there that will help you. So these are just a few examples of the resources you can find. Now for your go-to people when it comes to questions about the CRSS and working with folks, and we also mentioned these would be great people to connect your staff with in mentoring relationships. And those are the DMH Recovery Support Specialists. There's at least one in each region. I'm not going to mention all their names, but you'll see them on the next two slides. First one is Region 1 and 2. And then also Region 3, Region 4 and 5, and the Metro East St. Louis area as well. So these are great people to work with. Related to the CRSS. So now, in my mind, we go into what I think is the most important part of the presentation. We want to hear your thoughts and your questions. So if you have any questions at all on the CRSS or working with the CRSS or recovery support programs, feel free to ask those now. But we've also listed on this slide some questions that we have for you because we'd love to hear from you and give other folks on the phone an opportunity to hear about programs that you may have. So we'd like to ask you, the audience, to share any successes from your own recovery support program. And we recognize that there are a lot of organizations that have already navigated some of the waters of complex relationships with CRSS staff in your organization. And so we value that experience, and we want to hear how you've navigated some of these situations. Along the way, what resources have you found helpful? If you're participating together with CRSS staff with you on the call, what have been some of your reactions together to the content of today's training? So I apologize for the misspelling of the word participating there. That's my bad, but we'll continue. And then, of course, what questions do you have about today's topic? During the first webinar, we had over 70 different provider agencies listening in, representing all geographic areas of the state. So this is a wonderful opportunity to learn from one another. Go ahead, brag a little. That's okay. This is a very progressive and innovative area of work that we're all involved in, and anything you have to share, I'm sure will be valued by others. So with that, I'm going to hand this over to the moderator, who will give you some instructions for how to get in the queue to ask your questions or make some of your comments based on these questions on this slide. Thank you. Moderator?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone. Please record your name so I may announce you. To withdraw the request, press star 2. Once again, star 1 on your touch-tone phone if you do have a question at this time. One moment for the first question.
Thank you so much, moderator. We'll wait a moment for the first question.
And we do have one from Judy Scott. Your line is open.
Hi, Judy. Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to talk about the support that I've gotten from Virginia Goldrick since I came back off of disability. I only had 9 CEUs, and my credential was running out. And I came back in August, and I now only need 0.75 CEUs. So today will make me up to the 0.75. And I can't tell you how helpful that she's been to me since I've been back. It's just been a wonderful return to work.
Well, thank you, Judy. I think that raises a couple of important things. One is the importance of the CRSS professional keeping up on their CEUs. To maintain the credential. It is a competency-based credential, and so those continuing education units are really important. But secondly, the person you mentioned, Virginia Goldrick, in case folks in the audience aren't familiar, Virginia is one of the DMH Regional Recovery Support Specialists who is listed in the presentation. And so I think that just shows the value of having someone you can go to when you have an issue. You know, to be there for support, they've helped a lot of people in the past, and so chances are they can either answer your question or they can connect you with the person who can. So thanks, Judy, and thanks to Virginia as well.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Patricia Lindquist. Your line is open.
Good morning, everybody. This is Pat. I'm the Regional Recovery Support Specialist in Region 2, and I have a question. As regional support, how do we support peer staff who are not being included in the decision-making process? I'm wondering about support to the peers because they find it very frustrating, and also how could we educate agency supervisors? That's my question.
That's a great question. I can start, and then if anyone would like to add, you'd be welcome to. But I think that's a really good point. As a regional recovery support specialist, how can you be supportive where someone's having difficulty in a program, maybe with a supervisor? And I think here it's really important to honor the organization's chain of command and keep the lines of communication very open, just be, an active listener, because sometimes a person's asking for help and they want a solution. Other times they just want someone to hear what they have to say, an opportunity to vent. So discerning that with the person is really important, and asking them, is this something that you'd like help from me on, or how can I help you to prepare to go to your supervisor and talk through some of these issues? I had shared in a personal example earlier some difficulty that I had with the supervisor. And at that time, Nanette was actually the regional or network recovery support specialist back in those days. And so I remember I called Nanette and talked to her about some of those things. And, you know, Nanette didn't just jump in and fix my problem, but we talked about it, and she sort of validated some of my concerns. And it gave me some confidence to go back and talk to my supervisor myself, because when the issue is addressed there between the two individuals and impacts the most, that's what's going to be best for the working relationship, generally speaking. So, Nanette or Dan, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
Hi, Pat. I think that, you know, a couple of things came to my mind while, you know, Bryce was responding, and I kind of, one thing that I thought of is that it's possible that that others in the organization are not included in decisions either. And so just like we've been talking throughout this whole webinar about, you know, just like we treat all other employees, well, guess what? The CRSS staff or the peer specialists are in many cases being treated just like all other employees in negative ways, too. And so so where they feel, in some cases, it's not always true, but in some cases where they feel like they're being picked on, or they feel like they're being, you know, treated different. Sadly, they're being treated just as all the other staff are, and in those cases, it may not be a good thing, you know. And so, you know, the truth of the matter is that some organizations are very top down. Some organizations are very, you know, we tell you what to do and you do it, and they're not very inclusive in decision making. And that's an organizational culture. And so it may not be just about the, we don't think the peer specialist should be at the table. It may be about the whole organizational culture. And so sometimes helping the peer to see that they're being treated like everybody else helps them to feel better that they're not being picked on. That doesn't mean that we don't address the organizational culture, because I think that culture, you know, probably has some things that might need attention and might help all the employees to feel respected and to improve staff morale and all those kinds of things, but it may not just be about the peer staff in terms of that issue. In terms of an actual practical step that I thought of is that, you know, these webinars, you ask the question specifically, how can we educate the supervisor? Obviously, these webinars are the DMH's effort to educate the supervisor, and maybe the supervisor's not here. But the webinars are being posted, you know, after the fact. We're getting them posted to the website so that the PowerPoint slides are downloadable. And, you know, one way is for the peer staff themselves to bring those slides to their supervisor and say, this is a training I did, and, you know, and circle things and kind of walk through those things together, you know, in supervisory meetings. And another thing is just for in your role, you know, any one of our region recovery specialists can take this work that's all been done and continue to host trainings with those agencies that there are peer programs going on with, because we're only just doing this one time, you know, but it doesn't mean that it's the only opportunity. This whole program can be repeated in each region as many times as you see fit or you have opportunity to do so.
Yeah, take it and run with it.
Yeah.
Definitely. Thank you.
The next question I'm showing comes from Nancy Weed. Your line is open.
Welcome to the presentation, Nancy.
Thank you. And I really don't have a question, but some comments. First of all, as a supervisor and more recently a peer support specialist, I'm really excited to be able to supervise a couple of our peer supports. I think as a supervisor, one of the things to look at is our attitude that we personally come into working with peer supports. For me, I had the blessings of seeing one of our peer supports some years back when she was not doing very well in her recovery, and then seeing and being not in contact for some years, and then coming to work at the agency, and she came to work, I think, a little bit before I came, and seeing her recovery that was just, I don't want to say miraculous, but I get just so excited when I see the difference in her recovery and being able to share herself and support, and she uses the word coach, other clients in their recovery. And so I know that helped me personally with my attitude. And so even as a supervisor, I found myself selling peer support specialists to staff, to the case managers. So in some ways, I think we supervisors need to do a little bit of a sell job to see, maybe even, I don't know, personally, but also seeing the benefit, what the peer support can bring to our clients, and see some of the great recoveries that I know personally here that we're seeing. And a lot of it, a good portion of it is due to our peer support. And one of the things, last year our peer supports were at a different building, and I've been so excited that now we're housed in the same building, and so the communication has gotten so much better between case managers and peer support specialists. And I'm thinking of one where both the case manager and the peer support worked hand-in-hand with a client with some of the recovery that was needed and what the client was struggling with and needed that extra support. So I just get really excited about the peer supports. I guess I look at that attitude, and we supervisors have to look at our attitude in working with our peer supports. So, like I say, I'm really excited to be able to supervise the gals. The other thing I want to comment on is how to get peer supports involved. We have a staff meeting every Monday, and they are invited. They're with the case managers. We all 14 sit around a table. And so they're included in knowing what's going on and share ideas and so forth. And then also what we do is that afternoon we meet, the other supervisor, Alan and I, we meet with the peer supports. They plan the recovery center calendar. They come up with the ideas of what they want and see what is benefiting and really advocating for the clients, some of their interests. For example, we've had some bowling that has really taken off, and clients are asking for that because they're coming together and socializing and just really having a good time and coming out of their shells. And even people who have major depression and haven't been out of their homes that are saying, yeah, I want to come. So having them really be part of the meetings has been a blessing, and I know that's been helpful, and they feel that they're part of that team. So I share some of my comments.
Well, thank you, Nancy. I love your energy. Dan, would you like to respond?
Yeah, Nancy, I really applaud your approach and your enthusiasm about the skills and benefits of the person with the CRSS credential. As you were saying some of those things, it kind of brought back some memories of myself when working at an agency, and I think your approach gives that empowerment to that individual, gives that confidence that they do have these expertise, that, you know, they're unique. And I think that encouragement and that they get from you, and that participation in team meetings, whatever it may be, I just got to applaud you for your attitude towards this. And because to me, the more we can get involved with persons with the CRSS credential, I think it just creates that diverse opportunity to make those changes and see that improvement. Thank you.
Thank you.
I am showing no further questions at this time.
Okay, well, thank you, moderator. We will keep the line open for a little while, and I just want to remind folks of some of the questions that we had up there. We heard from Nancy some successes from her peer support program, but we'd love to hear from others. We know that there are mental health centers all across the state that have recovery support programs, and so we'd like to hear some of your successes.
We do have a question. Lisa Goodale, your line is open.
Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Welcome to the station.
Thanks. Really enjoyable. I wanted to both commend you for pointing out or suggesting that self-help and 12-step groups not be recorded in the clinical record. I suspect that might not be something that many settings have thought about. I wonder if all of you could just talk a little bit more both about why that's not advisable to record in the clinical record about those, but also maybe some strategies for, you know, for peers to be able to introduce that and talk about that and come to consensus in their workplace so that everybody's comfortable with that.
Sure, thanks. Well, to elaborate a little bit on the point about being cautious about charting for self-help groups, you know, there are a lot of, you know, there's community support group that's provided. So there are group situations where a person would chart on those. But in a self-help situation where a person comes into that with the understanding that, first of all, this is us helping each other. If it's a genuine self-help group, then the staff person isn't really the one that is, you know, providing a billable service, but the individuals there are there to help one another with what they've learned. And so, you know, it's a little bit different dynamic from, you know, a billable group. So I would say that's the main thing, the expectation that people are providing support to another. And also, if people come into the mental health center, let's say if there's a DBSA meeting there from the community and they're not a client of the mental health center, then, you know, if people are not expecting to be charted on, then we, you know, probably shouldn't be doing that. So that's what I meant there. Nanette had written me a note that you're from the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance, and so we're really glad to have someone from the DBSA on the call as well. What a great resource the DBSA is. I think anonymity in a self-help group is one of the things people come in there expecting, and so for that, there probably would not be charting. Thank you.
Yeah, I agree, and I don't think that sometimes settings think about those being different. They think about it as being a group, you know, like an educational group or something like that. So, again, I commend you for bringing that up.
Oh, thank you, Lisa.
Once again, if you do have a question, please press star 1 at this time.
Thank you, moderator.
And no one has queued up at this time, sir.
Okay. I'm just going to bring up this second question that we have here on the slide. In terms of how have you navigated the waters of complex relationships with CRSS staff in your organization, either with coworkers, with supervisors, with persons served? And what resources have you found helpful to you? We'd like to ask that of the audience because we know there are so many people on the call who have programs in existence. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you.
So actually, Bryce, while I have the potential moment, I'm actually going to ask you that question because I know that, you know, you and I talked about this recently in regard to how, speaking of lenses, we kind of had this metaphor throughout today's presentation, but how, you know, persons in recovery support, you know, wear a certain set of lenses, which is, you know, seeing things through the recovery support point of view. And persons in a more clinical field see things through those lenses. And working together, you know, when you have persons in recovery support working together with persons in clinical roles, that at times there's a complexity there. And the complexity comes from neither is right and neither is wrong, but we're seeing the same problem through a different set of lenses, and sometimes the approach to solving that problem is going to be different. And again, not one way is not better than the other, and one way is not right and the other wrong. It's just that we have a different approach. And so, you know, I remember in our conversation, and I'm seeing your nods of head, so I think you're remembering the discussion we had, but we talked about how, because in your role, you supervise staff that work on the peer support warm line, and they work alongside clinical staff who sometimes step in to help man that warm line, and they're not peer supporters, they're clinicians. And so can you talk a little bit about how you have helped to navigate those waters?
Sure. Thanks a lot, Nanette. I'd be happy to. So as Nanette said, at the Collaborative, we have what probably a lot of people have heard of, the Warm Line. That's peer support by telephone. And Dan Wilson here in the room with us is one of the staff who operates that phone line. And so the goal is to provide peer support to people. That's emotional support, recovery education, helping them to advocate for themselves. You know, those are the kinds of services that we provide in a proactive way. And part of the, you know, some of the outcomes we've seen from that are the prevention of a person going into crisis. And so a person, many people have been able to call in and talk to us about a situation before they were at that crisis point and have gained insights or just had someone listen to them in a refreshingly empathic way. That have helped them to actually avert a crisis, and we've gotten a lot of that feedback. But occasionally, someone will call in, and even though the warm line's not designed as a crisis line, there are lines available for that. We will occasionally get someone who, you know, expresses suicidal thinking or plans. And so what we have is we have a relationship between our recovery department and our clinical department. Both departments have staff on the phone, so we consult with each other on a daily basis. And so if we get a call where it seems, okay, this person might need more urgent help than I'm providing, they may need a clinical intervention, we will. We have a way for clinicians to come on the line, and we can stay on the line with them and work together to find the person the support that they need. And, you know, it's two different perspectives. You know, typically the recovery support perspective is I'm here to listen, and I'm here to de-escalate, help the person to de-escalate the situation and prevent a crisis, where our clinical staff would tend to come in with more of a how do we deal with this crisis and get the person that the emergent help that they need right now. And so when you bring those two perspectives together, you know, sometimes, you know, we'll have different thoughts about the way to handle things, but it's been a really beautiful and empowering process to just see how the departments work together and how the recovery support staff have come to really value some of those insights that the clinicians bring and the ability to get people hooked up with the emergency help they need if they need it. While at the same time, from the other end, it's a two-way street. The clinical staff, I've had them come to me and say, hey, you know, this person called and, you know, they weren't in a crisis, and so, you know, maybe it had something to do with service authorization. You know, they just wanted to talk about their feelings, you know, related to that, and we were able to give them the warm line. And there's this whole, like, empathic, everyone can be empathic, but this lived experience aspect is really helpful. And so you have both departments working together. And so while obviously most people listening in aren't primarily operating, like, a supportive phone line, the same kind of principles can exist in any supportive organization. Yeah. Thanks, Annette.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that with the audience, because I really thought that was a good conversation we had, and I thought it was a good principle, you know, because we do have to work together with people from, you know, that have different points of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we've developed our policies together between the two departments.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, we do have a few questions on the phone line whenever you're ready.
Excellent, we're ready.
Richard Peterson, your line is open.
Hi, Richard.
Please
Welcome
check your mute button.
Are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Welcome.
Okay, very good. This might appear to be a segue into what you were just talking about. I wanted to bring up as a resource the warm line, and I'm holding a wellness recovery action planning course right now, and one of the class participants found out about the course through the warm line, and I included my class on the Wellness Recovery Action Plan Locator, and I'm assuming that the person who was staffing the warm line referred the person to my class and is in the group right now getting the help that the class offers. I just wanted to make that point that it does work. I've got proof of it, and I'm happy to say that. The other point I had is to make is that my supervisor is very open to the recovery support specialist position, and it's almost so open that it's really difficult to be a part of the decision making process and doing the job as recovery support specialist, because people have so many needs, and I find myself being pulled in two directions. One, I want to be part of the decision-making process because I believe I have good insights to offer, but at the same time, I want to help the people whom I serve. Thank you.
Thanks, and I think Nanette would like to respond to that. Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, thank you very much, Richard. It's good to hear your voice, and I think that the point that you're making there at the last in regard to being difficult to do your job as a recovery support specialist and be part of the decision-making process is both encouraging and also, as you're expressing, I can't do all that, it's kind of the tug of progress, but the progress isn't completed yet. So, in other words, what you're reflecting is that in some parts of our system, and it sounds like where you are, it's true, that the progress that's evident is that your system recognizes the value of your voice, of the voice of recovery at the table. I can kind of respond from a personal point of view. Working for the Division of Mental Health, the wonderful thing that I can say has happened in the 12 years that I've been here is that we went from not even knowing that you should have this voice at the table to now having the DMH, mission statement is the expectation is recovery, and recovery is everywhere, and I can be and often am called to every single meeting. And, obviously I can't be at every single meeting because they're often happening all at the same time. So I can't be in 12 mm-hmm. places at once. And so what has to happen for that progress to be actualized is that the system has to expand past Richard Peterson to number one, the goal is not just to hire 20 more consumers or recovery specialists, but rather that for the organization to begin to develop that, to begin to internalize that recovery point of view such that they could have that voice even if you weren't personally at that table. So that even if you or your representative isn't at the table, that you would still feel confident that that point of view would still be spoken of. And so, my dream for the future is that, 10 years down the road, we're going to see less of a need for saying, do we have a recovery specialist at the table for decision-making, and more of a reality of organizations who have actualized that vision so much that they have that recovery point of view being spoken from the leadership who is at the table. But, you can't jump there. You can't skip the step of having the voice at the table. So sometimes it takes Richard Peterson's type persons like yourself engaging others, involving others who are willing to do it on a voluntary basis, whatever it takes, getting so that those voices are heard, but ultimately hoping that the organization evolves toward being able to represent that point of view without that
you know, I don't think of it as token. I don't think it's just a token. I think they genuinely want that recovery point of view at the table, but we want to see them internalize that to the point where somebody, even without Richard at the table, somebody's saying, well, wait a minute here. You know, I think that from a recovery perspective, and even if that person is not a person in recovery themselves, but they would begin to have that internalized ideology.
I think that's a great point, just to build on that just a little bit more. You know, I see my role as not just being like the recovery guy at the table, but of sometimes stepping away from the table and making room for other people to come in and you know, share their perspectives. And so as Nanette was saying, sometimes some of that can be voluntary or teaching other people in an organization, hey, you know, we're developing a new program. You know, maybe there's some people, persons served here that we have come in and tell us what they think, you know, what would make a good program or what are they interested in learning, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So I think those are just some of the insights that I know you bring, Richard, and are the value of having CRSS at the table.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Richard.
Okay, thank you very much.
The next question comes from Ginger Gardner. Your line is open.
Good
Hi,
morning.
Ginger,
I'm with the... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm with the Human Service Center in Peoria, and we have had a peer specialist program for probably over 10 years. And it has really done some evolving over the last year or two. We've made some changes, and right now I think it's been a huge blessing that we're able to use peer support right at the front door for new consumers that are coming in. And I think it has changed kind of the expectation and the hope of the people that are coming in, where they're able to be linked with somebody that is identifying with them at the same time as providing the hope of someone that's been there and done that and been involved in the services actually here with our agency. And it's just been a huge blessing, and I'm very grateful to be able to supervise the program we have here.
Well, that's wonderful, Ginger. I mean, what a powerful experience for someone just coming into a new place to receive services or maybe getting mental health services for the first time, for some of their first interactions to be with people who are living recovery. I mean, right there, that's just so powerful. And I'm really glad to hear about the progress that's been made there at the Human Service Center over time. Sounds like you guys have been, you know, really trailblazers. And a lot of this recovery support work is trailblazing. And so that gives me hope, and I'm sure gives other people hope, too, that, you know, these programs can change and adapt over time. And great that you have a growing program, Nanette.
Yeah, I think a comment and then a question back to you, Ginger, if I can. My comment is just how profound that is. You know, I think that it's almost like in some ways it's prevention against any other messages
yeah.
that persons you know, coming for services might potentially get from, you know, the less enlightened. You know, so I mean, I don't want to, you know, speak any particular discipline, but you know, there are still certain persons that, you know, have been working in this field for a long, long time who, you know, just find it, they feel compelled to tell people you'll never get better. And so it's like by having the first interaction at the door be with somebody who got better, you know, it's like they have this preventive message, like, yeah. Well, wait a minute here, I actually met somebody at your front door who received your services who got better. So I think that's really fantastic. So I think for our listening audience, Ginger, if you would share a little bit more about what the peer specialist role is at that front door, so to speak. What is it that they do for those new consumers as they're coming in?
Oh, sure. After an individual comes in to have their initial evaluation, we review weekly all the new assessments that that occur mm-hmm. over the week. And then they are recommended towards what we have called is the Pathways Group, which is led by peers. And so that is their first meeting after their evaluation. They come in, and it's kind of an orientation to the services that we have, but it is kind of introducing recovery on step one, you know, their first appointment in the building. And it gives them an opportunity to not just see the clinical textbook side of it. And it's a real person sitting possibly in the exact same chair that they sat in at some point. And one thing that I had taken, I guess kind of a, my ears kind of perked up when Nanette had said that, that peers, you know, really don't get the clinical training, but here we do kind of invite them and provide opportunity to teach them how to pull strengths out and how to use motivational interviewing to be able to meet a new person and be able to say, okay, we're glad you're here. What do you want to get out of this, and what have you done in the past that has or has not worked? And through what we have as a peer academy a couple times a year where we're able to bring clients that that we have, people that are actual consumers or consumers from other agencies that are in peer positions, to be able to teach them new skills to help them be even more effective when they are coming in contact with individuals that we service. So it's neat that they run the groups, and then they're still there when a person is a, you know, assigned to a primary staff person or a team, because the door to the peer support is open, whether you're in the Pathways group or we have people that return to Pathways for ongoing support a couple times a week that are already linked with teams and seeing a doctor and doing well or not so well. So it's neat that it's not conditional, and it's an open door, literally. And it seems to be working really well.
Great. And Dan would like to add something as well.
Yeah. As you were talking there, Ginger and Annette, is the fact that, you know, I see another, I guess, benefit, great benefit, as far as having that first experience of meeting someone appear as they come in the door, is to me it's a huge step as far as breaking down that stigma of coming in and, you know, asking for help, you know. So I think there's a lot of intimidation there about walking in the doors for the first time, what to expect and that sort of thing. So I really it kind of, you know, gave me goosebumps when you said, you know, that's a person's first experience is meeting their peer at the door. So that's outstanding.
Yeah,
it is great. We're pretty proud of that.
Great. And that's, you know, we're going to be talking more in the next webinar about professional training, and that has to do with training other staff in terms of what are, you know, what are the CRSS here for and what are some of those competencies, as well as ongoing training for the CRSS professionals themselves. So I just kind of wanted to make mention of that while the topic of training was sort of on the table. Well, thank you so much, Ginger, for those comments.
Certainly, and thanks so much for your webinar. This is this has been really good to help strengthen me to kind of put more in my toolbox as a supervisor as well. So thank you.
Excellent. Thanks.
Our next question comes from Robert Haggard. Your line is open.
Hi, Robert. Welcome to the presentation.
Thank you. I'm a peer counselor with Turning Point at the Living Room. We're in acute crisis respite. And generally, our perspective is often encouraged. And I feel very included. Both to call on life experience and our training, as well as being included in decision-making along the way in our program. I kind of wanted to bounce off what Lisa had said about anonymity, and part of our training was to not say where we're from in public areas or on a message, like on a telephone, and that's kind of a boundary issue, you know. Also, not speaking to a client that you see in public first, like let them make the first move. That's all I really had to say about anonymity, though. But I just wanted to say, you know, thanks for this call, too. And we're working on our CRSS, three of us are, and as peer counselors over at the agency. And we're just very grateful for the opportunity and for the respect that we get as peer counselors.
Thank you, Robert. So good to hear about the Turning Point Living Room and your program there, and that your perspectives. You feel really valued there, and you're asked to be at the table. That's outstanding. And it sounds, in terms of the anonymity piece, it sounds like your organization has had the conversation about the policy, and that's what we really want to emphasize today is not, you know, can't we all be a little more lenient in our policies? Not anything like that, but let's have the conversation about our policies. Let's look at them again with recovery specialists, with persons served, even more so, and see, okay, what's working, and how can we best protect people? And it sounds like your organization gets that that's the heart of the matter, is how do we protect people? So thanks for sharing.
Sure. Thanks for having us on the call.
Can I show one more question from Judy Scott? Your line is open.
Hi, Judy.
Hi. It's actually Virginia.
Hi, Virginia.
And I just wanted to ask about the loneliness of the CRSS. And maybe you have already addressed this earlier and I missed it, but what if there's only one of you? Who do you eat lunch with? And how, who do you ever get included in gossip and friendly contact and social contact? Where you work? That's my question.
Well, that's a great question. I know Dan had mentioned the word lonely specifically. Dan, I don't know if you can, if you'd be willing to respond to Virginia.
Oh, yeah, I'd be glad to. You know, that's a good question, Virginia, because I think that's probably something that a lot of folks do face. And, you know, in my own experience, it was a little intimidating coming into the agency, working for the agency that I received services for. And but I think that the biggest challenge was myself as far as, you know, being aware and accepting that, okay, my role has changed. You know, it doesn't make me a different person. It just, my role's different. And I think it took a lot of my initiative on my part to kind of open that pathway up with coworkers. You know, just kind of let them know that, you know, I'm not an alien from another planet that came to the agency. So, but I think it's important to understand that it's not only a change for the CRSS. You know, I think we have to accept and understand that this is also a change for the other staff. And I don't think anyone actually intentionally may cause these types of feelings, but I think it's just the understanding that they lack on both sides. And, you know, if you can get that connection between the CRSS and the staff and make it as a whole, I think there's a lot of relief between staff, because I know that other staff can be uncomfortable also not knowing how they should approach. So, you know, it's one of those things of getting the confidence to work together and learn from each other.
Yeah,
and Annette?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the good news is that we've come a long way, you know. The other news is that, you know, we still have to be cognizant of this issue, and we still have to really address it and be proactive about it. The reality is that in many situations, only one peer staff is being hired. And that's not recommended, and it's not advised, and it would be preferable to hire, say, two part-time peer staff than one full-time peer staff for a multiple of reasons, which we'll talk about in the program sustainability webinar, the fourth one. Your program's going to last longer if you hire more than one. But nevertheless, regarding the issue that Virginia's brought up, which is about loneliness, I kind of, as Dan was talking, jotted down some questions for the person who's feeling lonely to begin to ask themselves. So the person who's feeling lonely might start with, is this feeling of loneliness really just about my perception? In other words, have people actually, you know, avoided me, or am I just perceiving, you know, that I'm alone because I'm the only peer specialist, you know, because you can be the only peer specialist and not be alone. You know, you can have people that have been more than willing to include you in things. So, you know, is this a reality, or is this more about my perception of the reality? So I need to ask myself that question. And I think that, you know, I also need to ask myself a very difficult question, which is, are any of my own actions adding to this feeling of loneliness? Am I doing anything that is causing people to not want to be around me? And I can speak from my own perspective that I do some things that cause people to not socialize with me, and I'm okay with that. I'm totally okay with that. I don't like gossip. I don't want anything to do with it. So I don't want to be included in their gossip. And so if that makes me feel lonely, I got to accept the feeling of loneliness that comes along with not being included in gossip. But that's part of saying, are my actions adding to this? Because that's one of my actions. If you're gossiping, I'm probably going to walk away. You know, and so that's going to be one of my actions that might contribute to my own feeling of loneliness. And then I think another question that really has to be asked, which is part of Dan's presentation today, is, are there any actual policies or procedures that are contributing to my feeling lonely? And Dan had shared, not in today's presentation, but in our preparation sessions, he had shared this anecdote which just caused great uproarious laughter amongst us, except for that it wasn't funny. You know, because in his former job, you know, they had a policy that consumers of services, of which he had been one, you know, were not allowed in the room where the charts were held. And he was now hired as a staff person, and that room was also the room where the copy machine was located. And he, as a staff person, had multiple reasons that he needed to, you know, make copies. and there was a real problem. You know, the agency had a huge dilemma, and they could not figure out how to deal with this dilemma, you know, because Dan couldn't go in that room, you know, and it's just absurd. But that's a real actual policy that was contributing to his feelings of being isolated and lonely and left out. And so I think that if a person is experiencing loneliness on the job, you know, those are some questions that they could ask themselves to work through that in a more kind of helpful way.
Thanks, Annette and Bryce. And I just want to say that people can pick up the phone and call their regional recovery support specialist and have telephone support and interaction.
Thank you, definitely. Great questions and comments, Virginia. Moderator, do we have any other questions at this time?
I'm showing none, sir.
Okay, great. Well, that was a very nice, robust question and answer session. We really appreciate all the interaction, and we're looking forward to the next webinar and having even more interactions with folks. So we appreciate your feedback. We would ask that you please complete the webinar survey that will pop up at the end of the training, and I'm going to hand it over to Amy in a moment, who will close this out and give you more specifics there. But I also wanted to mention that if you have additional questions that you didn't get to ask today or you think of them later, then you may contact Trenda Hedges. She's on my staff. We have an email address there as well as a fax number. And you can also contact Trenda related to getting CEUs for today's training. We weren't able to get a sign-in sheet out ahead of time, but we plan, when we post this presentation PowerPoint on the website, we will also post a CEU sign-in sheet that you can get into Trenda. We would ask that if you could please get those in within 2 weeks from today, that would be very helpful. We will be providing CEUs if they're requested. So thanks there. Trenda Hedges' contact information, for those who don't have the webinar up on their screen, is Trenda, T-R-E-N-D-A, dot Hedges, H-E-D-G-E-S, at valueoptions.com. And her fax number is area code 217-801-9180. 8-9. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Amy Fricke, who will close out the webinar. Thank you, Amy.
All right. Thank you, Bryce. If there are no more questions in the queue or comments, then that will conclude our call for today. I would like to remind the audience that today's call audio and PowerPoint will be posted under the Provider Resources heading on the Provider Information page of the Collaborative's website in MP3 format. It will be available for download within 2 to 3 business days. I also would like to remind everyone that we value your feedback, so please take a few minutes to complete the brief survey that will appear when you close out of the online forum today. Holly, please push the speakers through to post-conference, and you may now disconnect the main line.
Thank you. This does conclude the conference. You may disconnect at this time. Have a great day.